A sandbox full, noted Decker. Which is why you see all those trucks hauling it in, replied Baker. Without sand, none of this works. Natural sand comes from Wisconsin. The ceramic stuff is imported from China. So the Bakken region is chock full of oil and gas, said Decker. Northwest corner of North Dakota hit the jackpot for fossil fuels. All told, the state is pumping about 2 million barrels of oil a day. To give you some perspective, the Saudis alone do around 12 million barrels a day. The Middle East in total has about half the world's total proven oil reserves and over 40% of the natural gas. Which is why everyone pays attention to what goes on there, noted Decker.
So most of the oil is trucked out?
Said Jameson. No, a lot of the oil captured here actually gets transported out via the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is a lot cheaper than trucking it to a train. But that pipeline is filling up fast, so they're building another one. Jameson said.
And this is one of Stuart McClellan's operations.
That's right. Decker said, the Air Force Station is close to here, and the Brothers Colony. Yep, McClellan's rigs are the only ones hereabouts except for one company also located near the Air Force Station.
What about all the gas flares?
Said Jameson.
Isn't that wasteful?
It is, conceded Baker. But there aren't enough pipelines here to transport the gas. And even if there were, the gas up here has a high percentage of hydrocarbons. Pipeline operators hate that because it can clog the pipe. What's the solution? Asked Decker. They're coming up with the technology to separate the methane from the hydrocarbons right on site. Do any problems come up with fracking? Asked Decker. He nodded. Something called a screen out is fairly common. That happens when the sand plugs up the perforations. The pump automatically shuts down when that happens because the PSI spikes and the warning bells go off.
What do you do to fix it?
Asked Jameson. We open the well and force up lots of barrels of fluid that we just sent down to clean up the blockage. If there are more serious issues, like a well needs some type of invasive intervention because it's deteriorating, equipment has corroded, or the reservoir conditions have changed, then we call in a workover rig. They'll drop in a wire line to lower both measurement and testing equipment to see what the issue is and arrive at a solution. They can usually find an answer and get it back online. Decker looked impressed. And here I always thought you were just a guy digging holes with a shovel. Baker grinned. Well, I did my share of that too, back in the old days. Now it's all technology and science and engineering. But hey, I'll take working inside a trailer with my own toilet and AC in the summer and heat in the winter any day.
Quite the operation,
noted Jameson. How long do you see yourself here, Stan? Asked Decker. Long enough to save up what I need to retire and to help out the kids in their education. Then I'm heading to Florida, chucking my cell phone into the ocean, and I'm going fishing. And I'm not going to stop till I croak. Now tell me what you remember about this guy who talked about the time bomb, said Decker. His name was Ben?
Yeah, at least that's what he said.
Last name? Baker rubbed his face and sat back in his chair. I'm not sure. It was over a year ago, and there were a lot of people around, and I'd been drinking. And you're sure he was in the Air Force?
Yeah, he was in his official camis, and he told me he was assigned there.
Decker said, what if we can show you pictures of people who worked there? Would that help?
It might, yeah, but how are you going to do that?
I was in the military. They don't like giving out info to nobody.
Decker glanced at Jameson.
We'll think of something.
Chapter 28.
How are we going to get Colonel Sumter to give up his list of personnel?
Said Jameson on the drive back.
He hasn't even gotten back to Kelly on his earlier request, and I don't see us getting a search warrant. We have no probable cause, and on top of that, this Ben guy was military. He's not there anymore, anyway. It's all Vector personnel now.
So let's dial up some help.
Decker pulled out the device Roby had given him.
What's that?
She asked. Apparently, a hotline to Batman.
He hit the green button. Within 2 seconds, Roby answered.
Yes. Need some help.
wondering if you could provide it. Tell me what it is and I'll see what I can do. We're looking for a guy who used to work at the Air Force station here. First name Ben, last name unknown. Is he military? Yes. We learned that the DOD pulled out the military component and outsourced the work to a firm named Vector. You know them? Why is this guy important? Said Roby, ignoring the query. He told a guy I trust that we were sitting on a ticking time bomb here, so I want to talk to him. I'll see what I can do. One more thing. Yeah? Irene Kramer. Any idea why the feds are interested in her? The line went dead. Jameson glanced at Decker.
Well?
Not sure. I might have just said something I shouldn't have.
They drove past the western edge of the Brothers Colony, where they saw colorful oil rigs erected along the way with trailers and trucks and lots of activity. Decker read the sign erected in front of one rig nearest the Air Force property, the All-American Energy Company. Two large stars and stripes were suspended from tall flagpoles and flapping in the breeze. Decker said dryly,
"Well, that's patriotic."
"What could be more American than drilling for oil?"
quipped Jameson.
Kelly said, "We've had a bolo out on Parker from the minute we found him missing. There's been no sign of the guy."
They were walking to the room where the post-mortem had been performed by Walt Southern on Pamela Ames.
"I guess around here there are lots of places to get rid of a body,"
said Jameson.
"Yep, we got landfills full of crap that they add to every day, including some radioactive stuff that comes naturally out of the drilling process."
"Radioactive,"
said Jameson.
"And they can just dump that in a landfill?"
"Well, they're not supposed to. But people aren't supposed to do lots of things, and they still do."
"That's why we have a job," grumbled Decker.
As they entered the room, Southern was finishing up some notes in a paper file. He eyed Decker warily.
"Heard you came back to look at Kramer's body while I was out of town."
"I did."
"It looks like you opened her up again."
"I did,"
Decker said again.
"Why?"
he said sharply.
"Because I had to. Now, I'd prefer to talk about Ames's post."
Southern started to say something, but then seemed to catch himself.
"Okay, not much to tell. Dead about 14 hours when you found her. Single contact GSW to the right temple. Dum-dum round."
He held up a baggie with the round inside.
"All beaten to hell. No striations, lands, or grooves visible. Did what it's designed to do. Won't get a ballistic match off it."
14 hours,
said Kelly. "So around 10 o'clock at night?"
Southern glanced at his notes.
"About, yes."
"Stomach contents?"
"Some dinner, half digested. That's it. Tox screens have been sent out. I found no obvious signs of drug use. No sign of a sexual assault or recent sexual intercourse."
Kelly nodded but said nothing. He was watching Decker. Decker said,
"Did you confirm that nobody cut her up, like they did Kramer? We didn't look under her clothing, just noted the gunshot wound and bagged her for the post."
Jameson looked at her partner in surprise because this was an unusual thing to say, but from the look on Decker's face, the man had a reason. Southern slowly put down his file.
"Do I have to read between those lines, or are you going to come to the point?"
"You noted that Kramer's stomach and small intestines were sliced open." "Sliced? I don't need to tell you those places are pretty popular to hide contraband. When I asked you if there was anything unusual in the post, you never mentioned either of those things. Now I'd like an explanation for that."
"They were in my report."
"But they were not highlighted. They were buried, in fact. A single sentence for both organs. And you took no photos of them. You should have drawn our attention to them. That's standard protocol."
To this, Southern shrugged.
"But you found out about them, so what's the problem? No harm, no foul."
"If you have to ask a question like that, I'm not sure you're in the job you need to be in."
Southern scowled.
"I do this out of a sense of public duty. It's not like they pay much."
Decker glanced at Kelly, who didn't look inclined to say anything. Southern said,
"So you think she might have had something inside her?"
"Did you find any trace of that?"
said Jameson.
"Because if you did, it wasn't in your report," noted Decker.
"That's because I found no trace of any foreign substance inside her stomach or intestines."
"And you specifically looked?" asked Decker.
"I checked the organs."
"Did you give the stomach and intestines a more focused look because of the way in which they had been sliced open?"
Decker wanted to know.
"I was thorough, and that's all I'm going to say on the matter. If you got a problem with that, you can take it up with Joe. Now, if we're done here, I'll have my very thorough report ready for you later today."
And with that, Southern walked out. Decker stood there for a minute and then walked over to the body of Pamela Ames and lifted the sheet. The Y incision stared back at him along with the dead woman's pale face.
"No electric blue light again," thought Decker. "My brain keeps me guessing, and I don't much care for it. No, I hate it."
"Decker,"
Jameson said, coming to stand next to him.
"You okay?"
Decker curtly nodded. Kelly said,
"I wish you could have given me a heads up on all that."
"What are you going to do about it now that you know?"
"What can I do? It was in the report, right?"
"Not where it optimally should have been."
"Optimally? I can't take that and run with it. Hell, without Walt, we don't have anyone here who can do posts. I don't see that I have many options."
"I would think that you have options for somebody like that."
"You can't believe that Walt would have intentionally..."
Decker cut him off.
"I don't believe or disbelieve anything until I can prove it. Just so we're straight on that."
He put the cover back on Ames's remains, then walked out of the room and slammed the door behind him.
"I take it he's pissed," said Kelly.
"And I think he has every right to be,"
retorted Jameson. And with that, Jameson left, leaving Joe Kelly alone with a corpse. Chapter 29. Will Roby was on the move. It was night, and a warm rain was falling. He was on foot, dressed in a camouflaged ghillie suit, with a pair of night optics and a GPS tracker mounted on his forearm. Under the ghillie was level 3A body armor, along with rifle plates that could stop and disperse all handgun rounds and most rifle rounds. They offered superb stab and spike protection as well. Unless someone got a head or femoral artery shot on him, then it was over. He took up position on a slight rise of earth and surveyed the area in front of him through the optics. To the left were the lights of the Brothers Colony, and to the right those of the Air Force Station. And then there were the oil rigs surrounding these two facilities, like a hostile army rigging an enemy. There was movement at the oil rigs as people and trucks came and went. He could see the lights of vehicles moving across the land owned by the brothers. The radar array sat high above all this activity as it scanned the night skies for incoming nukes and other space traffic. Amos Decker had been described to him in three precise words: brilliant, quirky, relentless. After meeting the man, he hadn't gotten to see the quirky part so much, but Decker certainly seemed intelligent enough. And he hoped the relentless part was spot on, because the man was going to need it. His partner, Alex Jameson, had an excellent rep at the Bureau. Partners were important, Roby knew. He was missing his partner on this assignment. Jessica Reel was currently in a different and more dangerous part of the world. Although this area of North Dakota certainly seemed to have its share of violence. He got up from his position and moved forward with efficient strides of his long legs. The outer perimeter of the Air Force Station loomed in front of him. Roby's people had tried to do this the nice way and had gotten zip for their politeness. Now Roby had been sent here to do it the impolite way. He had brought some tools with him in case he came across any opposition, but had been instructed to use them judiciously. His orders were also to not kill anyone in his path tonight. Of course, those on the other side would have no compunction about doing that to him, since they would see him as only an intruder. An intruder looking for the truth, but an intruder nonetheless. He had a map of the facility downloaded on his phone, and he stopped to take a brief scan of the outer perimeter. It was sophisticated and had been thoughtfully implemented by people who knew what they were doing. Yet he had been told about a sliver of a blind spot in the facility's defenses. It took him 10 seconds to scale the first perimeter fence. His gloves with metal mesh palms allowed him to easily circumvent the concertina wire atop the fence. He dropped down to the other side and eyed the ground in front of him. Fortunately, he knew that pressure plates aligned at 2-foot intervals and set at 45-degree angles ran off the support posts for the fence. Best-case scenario, if he stepped on one, an alarm would go off. Worst-case scenario, Roby would be blown to nothing. He picked his steps carefully and safely reached the interior perimeter fence. This had double rows of razor wire toppers, and it took him longer to get over it than he ideally wanted. He dropped silently to the ground and squatted there, watching and listening. This endeavor made up 3/4 of most of his missions. This was the part that allowed him to live. So he paid attention to it, gave it the due it deserved. He wanted to walk out of here, not be carried out in a body bag. Now the easy part was over. The one unknown for him was whether they deployed dogs here. His intel had been sketchy on that. Dogs were almost impossible to defeat, at least for long. But if they were present, he had brought something that would help him overcome this obstacle. There were surveillance cameras along the pedestrian routes, but he also knew where each of them was, and he stayed out of their lines of sight. He saw the first sentry up ahead, dressed in black, with body armor, and carrying a subgun with a 30-round extended mag and a walkie-talkie attached by Velcro to his shirt front. A sweep light mounted on a tower was making its rounds over the ground. Roby watched its routine and then moved forward, avoiding its glare. He drew to a stop about 15 feet later and waited for the guard to finish his walk. When he disappeared around the corner of one building, Roby crept forward, his gaze moving across the area in front of him, side to side, then a look backward to check his full rear flank. 2 more guards appeared on the scene, and they were joined by another, not an armed guard, but a woman dressed in civilian clothes. They all shared a smoke and talked. Roby strained to hear what they were saying, but couldn't quite make it out. The woman finally left, and the guards moved on, one going right and the other left. Roby skirted along the shadows, occasionally looking down at his GPS tracker and the facility map on his phone. The building he wanted was up on the right. He reached the door, but, after looking at it, decided not to make his entry that way. He crept around the corner and eyed the window there. Basic snip lock, blinds half drawn. He risked hitting the window with his light to check the inside edge for signs of an alarm port. He saw none. That was when he heard someone coming. With his knife, he flipped the lock, raised the window, slipped inside, and closed it a few seconds before a figure passed by. As he gazed out the window in the direction of the pyramid building, he saw something extraordinary. 3 guards came out of a side door, pushing 2 gurneys with 2 men lying on them. They hurried over to the ambulances parked there and loaded the gurneys into the back of one of them, and 2 guards climbed into the rear. A driver must have already been in the vehicle because it started up, geared into reverse, and pulled out, its taillights winking as it drove away. Roby had taken pictures of all this with his phone. He lowered the blinds, turned away from the window, and looked around the small office he was in. There was a desk with large American and U.S. Air Force flags resting in stands behind it. Gunmetal gray file cabinets were parked against one wall. That was his target. In the digital world, the military could still be counted on to also deal in good, old-fashioned paper products. He slid open each drawer until he found the one he wanted. Personnel files. He went through them as quickly as possible, holding a penlight in his mouth and shining its light into the drawer to keep as much of the illumination as possible hidden. 20 minutes later, his hand closed around the file he wanted, after he made sure there were no others that fit the bill. He took pictures of each page with his phone camera, put the file back, closed up the drawer, and turned to leave. right as someone walked up to the door and he heard a key being inserted into the lock. Chapter 30. It was the same woman. Up close, she was around 30, with straight blonde hair that fell to her shoulders, an athletic build, and resolute, focused, intelligent features. She shut the door, clicked on the light, and moved over to a desk by the window. She sat down, opened the desk drawer after unlocking it, and pulled out some files. As she sat at her desk, she was intently focused on the documents in front of her, so much so that she didn't notice it at first. The sound, that is. Or sounds. But the collective noises outside finally made her glance that way. She stiffened, and then, as the sounds became more recognizable, she relaxed. She was about to turn back when the woman tensed again as she looked at the window. Now it wasn't simply the noise that had jarred her. It was something else, far more tangible, literally staring her in the face. Her hand immediately went to the phone on the desk. She had barely picked up the receiver when she collapsed forward. Roby stood next to her, having come out from his hiding place behind the flags. He had on a small gas mask and was holding a bottle in his hand. The knockout spray had an amnesiac component to it. When she woke up, she would remember nothing. He glanced at the window. She had no doubt seen that the blinds had been fully lowered. She might have been in the office earlier and could have even been the one to raise the blinds. She had probably been about to call security when Roby had stopped her. He darted to the window, edged the blinds aside, and peered out. There definitely appeared to be more activity out there. The sounds had lessened somewhat, but they were still there. He waited 3 beats for the noises to move away, and then took his opportunity to escape. Outside, he reversed his course and made his way to the inner security fence. Before he got there, he heard the sound above and looked up. Maybe that was the source of all the ruckus going on here. The small jet was coming in for a landing on the runway that ran east to west behind the buildings that constituted the Air Force station. The landing gear hit the asphalt, and the pilots applied the brakes along with the thrust reversers, and the small jet rolled to a stop. As it did so, several people hurried over to the plane, and a golf cart drove up and parked next to the aircraft. Someone of importance was clearly arriving. For Roby, the temptation to see who was getting off the ride was too strong, overriding his good sense. But in Roby's line of work, one's personal safety was not paramount. His focus was mission-centric. He had come to gather intel, and this alone might be well worth the clandestine visit. In fact, this might be just as important as what he had found in the file cabinet. He reversed course and edged along the side of a building until he gained a sight line to the runway as the plane's air stairs came down. Roby moved closer still as a few moments later the passengers began to deplane. The first person off was a tall man around 50 with broad shoulders. He was not in uniform, but rather in a trim, dark suit with no tie. The second person off was a woman, also around 50, dressed in a gray pantsuit. She clutched a soft-sided leather briefcase. The last person off was another woman, younger, dressed in a dark skirt with a matching jacket. She was checking something on her phone. Roby watched all of this and even managed to snap pictures using the camera built into his optics. He followed their movements as they walked over and climbed into the golf cart. As soon as they were in their seats, the vehicle zipped off. Roby took some more pictures before the cart turned and disappeared between 2 buildings. The next moment, Roby was off and running, because it was clear to him now that they did indeed have dogs here, and they had picked up on his presence. As he ran, he took 3 items from his pocket and tossed them behind him in a triangle-shaped pattern, each about 5 feet apart from the other. He glanced back. The beasts were running free. Luckily, their handlers were nowhere in sight because while Roby had a chance with the canines, he had no chance against a fired bullet. There were 2 of them. One a German shepherd that looked big enough and vicious enough to rip his arm off. The other a smaller Rottweiler who looked even meaner. Roby had it on good authority that the surprises he had left behind would do the trick and that even the best trained dogs would not be able to resist, even when in full chase mode. He hoped the authority was really that good. Both dogs skidded to a halt and attacked what he had left behind. As soon as they took a bite of what he had dropped, they wobbled and fell over. They would be super attack dogs again, but only long after Roby was gone. He scaled the fence twice as fast as he had coming in, and successfully avoided the pressure plates. The fired round came out of nowhere and hit him on the lower right side of his back. The plate absorbed the kinetic energy and flung it across the face of the vest. Roby wasn't dead, but he felt like he'd been kicked by a seriously pissed off 1,000-pound mule. The second fence was climbed even faster than the first. He dropped onto the other side as the searchlight began its sweep and alarms blared throughout the complex. He immediately hoofed it into the darkness. But then his life got even more complicated. Will Roby would have expected nothing less. Chapter 31. The chopper lifted off a helipad and swiftly moved west, hot on the trail of the intruder. A searchlight sparked to life on the starboard side of the aircraft. Its beam bore down over the countryside, dramatically illuminating the flat, dark land as though it were suddenly aflame. A few moments later, the beam caught and held on its target. A second later, the SUV roared to life and its headlights came on. Before it could drive off, though, the chopper was hovering in front of the vehicle, its 50-caliber nose cannon pointed right at the windshield. One rumble from the weapon, and the SUV would be shredded, and the occupant dead in a non-survivable field of fire. Over the PA system, the pilot ordered the driver to step out of the vehicle. The driver did not comply with this order. The chopper hovered there for another minute while the pilot communicated with the higher-ups on what they wanted done with the situation. A minute later, the chopper landed, and four heavily armed and armored men climbed from it and surrounded the SUV. When their orders to come out were not obeyed, they were about to force the issue when the SUV horn started blaring loudly. The men took a step back as the driver's side window started to come down. Every man pointed his assault rifle at this spot, ready to open fire the moment a weapon appeared. The glass hit the bottom and stopped. The blaring horn ceased, and the truck's engine cut off. The men looked at one another before charging forward. They reached the side of the truck and peered inside. The front seats were empty, the back seats the same. The rear cargo area held nothing. The curses could be heard over all their collective compacts when this was relayed back up the chain of command. Will Roby kept the throttle on the electric scooter wound as far as it could go, as the little bike, its headlight off, moved nearly silently over the quiet roads. He was already miles away from the site of where he'd parked the truck in which he'd carried the scooter. He'd programmed in the truck starting, horn blaring, lights coming on, window coming down, and engine cutting off, then executed all of those commands through his phone app. He had watched the chopper and strike team approach the vehicle through a camera built into the grille of the truck, with the video feed going directly to his phone. He veered down a side road and ditched the scooter in an abandoned shed as prearranged. He drove off in a pickup truck that had been left there for his use after stripping off his gear, underneath which he wore jeans, a corduroy shirt, and boots. A Stetson hat completed his disguise. He could be a local coming home from either a bar or a job. He made it back to town in 3/4 of the time it had taken him to drive out. He parked the truck behind the hotel where Decker and Jameson were staying. Decker was sound asleep in his bed when he heard a slight noise that made him sit up.
"Piece of advice, you might want to become a lighter sleeper."
Decker clicked on the nightstand light and looked over at Roby sitting in a chair with a placid expression. Roby held up his phone.
"I just sent you some documents and pictures. I'm here to provide context."
"What do the pictures and docs concern?"
"Ben Purdy, who used to work at London AFS."
"Used to? When did he leave?"
"Around the time they transitioned to Vector."
"Where is he now?"
"Don't know. And his papers don't say. That's a puzzler,
because they would normally list what his next deployment was. The files I looked at for other personnel all did. Decker picked up the phone off the nightstand and opened the email. He took a minute to scan down the pages that Roby had photographed.
How'd you get these?
Roby just looked at him.
Do they know someone was there tonight? Asked Decker.
This comment drew a look of respect from Roby.
Or was it clean? Added Decker.
My exit was not as clean as I would have liked, but they won't know what my area of interest was. That I can guarantee.
That's good to know.
What are you going to do now?
Show the picture to someone to make sure it's the right guy. We don't need you showing this picture all around. I'm only going to show it to one guy, a person I trust implicitly.
I hope your trust is well placed.
It is. That I can guarantee you.
And if it is the right guy? Asked Roby.
Then we need to track down this Ben Purdy.
And if you can't? Decker looked at him.
Why would that be a problem? Even if his current assignment wasn't in the file, he's in the Air Force, not in hiding.
He was in the Air Force. We don't know if he still is. And if you find him, he may not talk, for a number of reasons, he added grimly.
You think it goes that deep?
Roby ran his fingers along the chair's armrest.
FYI, I wouldn't be here otherwise. That's also good to know.
Anything else?
When I asked you about Irene Kramer, you hung up on me. Why?
I had nothing to contribute to that discussion.
You have a funny way of not answering questions.
Goes with the territory I call home.
I can deal with half-assed answers and even outright lies, because pretty much everybody lies to me at some point. But to solve the case, I have to get to the truth. And FYI, I will.
Roby eyed the phone.
Those are the facts. Do with them what you think is best.
He rose from the chair, a bit stiffly. This was not missed by Decker.
I take it the non-clean exit was also painful?
They almost always are. Roby was at the door when Decker said,
I know getting this wasn't easy. Thanks.
Roby turned back long enough to say,
It's my job. Now do yours.
Chapter 32.
That's the guy, said Baker.
He, Decker, and Jameson were having coffee the next morning at a cafe down the street from their hotel. Decker had shown him the picture of Ben Purdy that Roby had sent him.
You sure?
Oh, yeah, that's him. He's still around? Haven't seen him since that night.
All the military guys are gone except for the man who runs the place, Colonel Sumter. The rest are private contractors.
Baker shook his head.
Never liked those guys. They were paid 3 times what us grunts got and did a quarter of the work we did.
He eyed Decker.
Where'd you get that picture?
Jameson glanced at her partner. Decker had already told her about the encounter with Roby.
Just good old-fashioned police work, Stan, said Decker,
taking his phone with the photo on it back as Jameson hiked her eyebrows at this comment.
If he's gone, how are you going to talk to him?
Have to think of a way. Did he say anything else to you? Talk about his family, friends, anything that might help us track him down?
Well, he said his family was from Montana, just over the border.
Decker sat up.
Did he mention a town?
No, just that it was small and rural. I guess most of Montana is rural.
He checked his watch.
I gotta get going. I'm normally at work by now, but we had some repairs to make, and we don't start staging for another 2 hours.
Thanks, Stan. See you later.
Hey, Caroline wanted me to ask if you two wanted to join us for dinner tonight.
Dinner?
Said Decker.
I don't...
But Jameson interjected.
That would be great, Stan.
Baker grinned.
I'll email you with the details. You'll love the restaurant. It's a pretty special place.
Before they could comment on this, Baker hurried off. Decker whirled on Jameson, who put up her hand.
He's your brother-in-law.
Soon to be ex.
Is he your friend? Do you like him?
Well, yes. He's a nice guy, solid as a rock.
And didn't you two just fight off a bunch of guys together?
Well, yeah.
The point is, he invited us to dinner. We should accept. At the very least, we might learn something that could be helpful.
Decker fingered his coffee, looking uncertain.
What?
She said.
If you want the truth, I guess I'm pissed that he seems so happy. Without my sister. I know that's stupid and petty, but...
Jameson put a hand on his shoulder.
And it's also normal to feel that way after something like this happens to a family member, but you have to let it go. It's his life to live, not yours. Don't judge him, Decker. Just support him. Like you just said, he's a good guy.
He refocused and said,
If Purdy's family lives in Montana, just over the border, we should be able to find them.
It's a long border, Decker. What about Roby? Could he help?
He got us the photo and the name. He did his job. His forte is not running stuff down in a database or interviewing witnesses. We should be able to do that.
In a normal case, yes, but this is apparently not a normal case.
Decker thought about this for a long moment, took out his phone, and punched in a number.
Who are you calling?
She asked.
A professional colleague. Hello, Bernie. It's Amos Decker. Yeah, it has been a long time. Yeah, still doing PI. Look, I'm on a job for a client who's trying to track a deadbeat dad. Name's Ben Purdy. He's in the Air Force, but I think he might be AWOL. So he's got bigger problems than alimony and child support. We tried to garnish, but the guy's gone all cash and the military's not been very helpful. Right, I know. Same old story. Now we got a lead on some of his family being in Montana, near the North Dakota border. I remember you know a guy out that way who was pretty good. Any chance you dial him up and get some intel for me on Purdy and his family? An address for them, because I happen to be out that way?
Decker paused and listened.
Yeah, that's right. That'll work. Give him my number so you don't have to be caught in the middle. Right, thanks, Bernie. Beer's on me next time, and I'll cover the guys hourly.
He clicked off and looked at Jameson. She stared back at him incredulously.
You just called in a favor from what, your private PI boys club? I thought that only happened in the movies.
Bernie Hoffman used to be a homicide detective in Cincinnati. We got to know and trust each other working some joint cases. About the time I went private, so did he. We helped each other back then, too. I remember he had a really good guy in South Dakota. Bernie will put him on the case and we'll see what pops. And it's not a favor. I'm paying the guy.
When she kept staring at him, he said,
What?
Well, you handled that so deftly over the phone. I mean, you weren't,
Her voice trailed off and she looked a little embarrassed.
I get tongue-tied in social situations, Alex. Put me in the middle of a dinner or a party or anything like that. I'm not your guy for eloquence or even stringing a few words together. But when it comes to what I do for a living, I don't have that problem. I thought you would have remembered that from our first few encounters back in Ohio.
She smiled, shamefaced.
You're right about that. Okay. So what do you think Purdy meant when he said they were all sitting on a time bomb here?
He could have been speaking metaphorically, or literally.
The latter gives me the chills.
Roby got the photo by breaking into the military facility.
A wide-eyed Jameson said,
You didn't tell me that part. Did he actually say that?
He didn't have to, but it was a close call for the guy, and he strikes me as the sort who can pretty much go where he wants, so the security there must be tough.
Well, it is a secret government facility,
said Jameson.
Yeah, I just wonder what the secret is.
What do you mean?
In response, Decker brought up some photos on his phone.
Roby didn't tell me about these. I guess he thought the photos would speak for themselves, and they sort of do.
He showed Jameson shots of the men on the gurney being taken to the ambulance and the man and two women getting off the jet.
I wonder who they are,
said Jameson.
And I wonder what happened to the men on the gurneys. Sumter said the place was really safe. No accidents.
Well, maybe what happened to them was no accident, replied Decker.
Chapter 33. The room was dark. Any illumination appeared to be coming from a lamp in another area. A man sat in a comfortable upholstered chair. He was dressed in a suit, crisp white shirt, and a tie. His winged loafers were polished. His hair was salt and pepper. His face was creased with decades worth of worry, all honestly earned while serving on behalf of his country. His demeanor was calm. He was used to projecting such a facade in times of extreme peril. This was one of those times. His code name was Blue Man, which denoted the sky-high ring of seniority of which he was a member in America's intelligence apparatus. Will Roby sat opposite him.
"Amos Decker has the information?" asked Blue Man.
"He does, plus the photos."
"Good fortune shone on you last night, Roby."
"It didn't feel like it at the time." "How's Jess?"
"Busy,"
was all that Blue Man would say on that.
"Now, I take it from your overall demeanor that you wonder why we are not performing a full frontal assault on this particular problem."
"I do what I'm tasked to do," said Roby evenly.
"But still."
"Yes," said Roby, "but still."
Blue Man held up one of his hands.
"Unfortunately, we have one of these tied behind our back, Roby. Very tightly, in fact."
"Is that so?"
"Powerful interests are arrayed all over this situation. The problem is, while they are arrayed, they are not aligned with our interests."
"Money?"
"And power. Now, if we knew for sure, with demonstrable proof, what is going on, it would be different. Without that, I can't even get a meeting. I can't even get an email returned. People would rather ignore a potential problem in the hope that it will go away."
"And when it doesn't?"
Blue Man looked dubiously at him.
"You've been in this game long enough to know that when it doesn't, those who ducked their responsibilities will point fingers at others. That apparently qualifies as leadership in certain places."
"Don't you get tired of this shit, sir?"
"I became tired of it my first day on the job."
Blue Man leaned forward.
"But if all of us who hate the status quo were to leave, then the status quo would not only remain, it would become intractable."
"Meaning evil only wins."
"When good men and women do nothing. I choose to do something."
"So what now?" asked Roby.
"Do you think he can find Ben Purdy?"
"If anyone can, I think Decker can."
"I have a good friend at the Bureau. He speaks very highly of Decker. In fact, he told me Decker is the best pure investigator that the FBI has. He also said that Decker has some quirks."
Roby nodded.
"I read the file. The man's entitled to some quirks after what happened to him."
"Agreed."
"Vector," said Roby.
"A recently created company but already embedded throughout the DOD's operations with a cavalry of powerful political allies whom they have bought and paid for."
"But there's something going on out there that doesn't jibe with their mission."
"For various reasons, I have been concerned with the Douglas S. George Defense Complex ever since Vector was given the contract to take over operations."
"But with an Air Force colonel, Mark Sumter, in charge."
Blue Man waved this off.
"He's a titular placeholder, a career soldier who, unfortunately, will follow any order he's given without gauging the moral or legal virtue of it."
"Which may be one of the reasons why he got the assignment."
"I think it's the only reason he got the assignment."
"Radar array, eye in the sky," said Roby.
"Officially, yes."
"Unofficially?"
Blue Man settled more deeply in his seat.
"The walls of secrecy have always existed within the American IC, he said, referring to the intelligence community. "But I have never seen it so compartmentalized. Secrets are being kept everywhere. DOJ, DHS, DOD, and all their related platforms. Members of both parties in Congress have made inquiries and met a stone wall in response."
"Meaning something might be going on there other than what we think is?"
Blue Man said.
"It actually might be fortunate that Irene Kramer turned up dead here."
"Not so fortunate for her."
"I'm only talking about the bigger, strategic picture. Her murder has engaged the official machinery of the FBI. They might be able to make some headway where we could not. You know that we have no authority to operate domestically."
"They already tried to kill Decker."
"Which is why you were sent out, to prevent that from happening. And you did."
the body was disposed of?
Inquired Roby.
Yes. He was a gun for hire, with no possible route back to who hired him.
Any guesses?
We can't guess, Roby. We don't have time for it.
Roby cocked his head.
And why were the FBI called in? It has to do with Kramer. Decker asked me about her. I had nothing to tell him.
And I have nothing to tell you on that subject. Perhaps at a later time.
Roby took this in stride. He was used to not having the full story on any op in which he was called in.
Okay, but she must have been important to us.
She may be more important to us in death than she was in life. But I, for one, believe that every death such as she suffered must lead to justice and punishment.
Blue Man gave him a curt nod, and Roby rose to go back to work.
Look out for Decker and his partner with the greatest care, Roby.
Will Roby didn't say anything. He didn't have to.
Chapter 34.
Sumter hasn't gotten back to me, said Kelly as he joined Decker and Jameson by prearrangement in the lobby of their hotel.
He had on a gray two-piece suit and white shirt, but instead of scuffed boots, he wore black loafers.
That's telling, said Decker.
The DOD works like a glacier. At least that's been my experience.
Sumter came here about a year ago?
That's right, when the operation of the facility transitioned.
What do you know about Vector?
Not much, but they got a lot of people over there, and most of them carry weapons, the very serious kind.
Got a question, said Decker.
Shoot.
Why all the ambulances over at the Air Force Station? Sumter said it was a really safe place, no accidents. So I don't see the need.
Kelly looked at him shrewdly.
You asked that when we were over there.
And I didn't get an answer. Thought I'd tee it up again.
You think I'm supposed to know?
I think you might have an opinion.
Well, the easiest answer is all military facilities prepare for worst case, so having ambulances there might just be for that reason.
And it might not. A lot of security there for a radar array. I mean, it's not like someone can go in and steal that pyramid.
But they can sabotage it, countered Kelly.
Okay, I'll give you that one, conceded Decker.
Why do you care about any of that? Asked Kelly.
I care if there's something going on over there that might be tied to Irene Kramer.
I don't see a connection.
It's our job to find one, if there is one.
Well, like I said, I've heard nothing back.
Then we have to move forward in other directions.
And where would that be? Asked Kelly.
I'd like to go back to the Brothers Colony.
What do you expect to get there?
Irene Kramer worked there. We might have missed something. At the very least, we can talk to other people. A lead might shake out from that.
I'll give them a heads up that we're coming. But let's tread carefully. They've all been hit hard by this.
I'm sure they have. And the sooner we solve this, the sooner they can get on with their lives. The not knowing probably isn't good for them.
That's a fair point, conceded Kelly.
He suddenly gave Decker a hard stare.
Some young punks went to the hospital the other night with assorted injuries. Nothing too serious. You know anything about that?
Why would I?
They didn't file a police report, but one of my guys was over there interviewing some other dumbbells who got into an altercation. That's how he hooked up with them. They said it was a couple of really big, rough-looking guys who took them out. 6 against 2, and the two kicked some serious ass. Surprised they admitted to that, but I think even they were impressed. Sure you don't know anything about that?
A lot of really big, rough-looking guys in this town.
Yeah, there are, said Kelly, not looking convinced.
You want to call the brothers so we can head out? Said Decker. I'll go bring the SUV around.
He left Kelly and Jameson there. Kelly eyed her.
So what exactly is going on?
I don't know what you mean.
You going down the obfuscation road too?
Wow, that's an SAT word if ever I heard one.
Where do you think I got it? Replied Kelly.
On the drive out to the colony, they passed the All-American Energy Company's oil well site, which bordered both the Brothers' land and the Air Force Station.
Colonel Sumter really hates all this stuff right next to his installation,
said Jameson.
I guess I can understand that. I mean, what if there's an accident with one of those oil rigs, a fire or something? It could affect what he's doing over there.
Kelly stuck an unlighted cigarette in his mouth.
Like shooting fish in a barrel.
What is?
Asked Jameson.
Drilling for oil around here.
You ever think about getting into the fracking business?
Asked Jameson. He shook his head.
I prefer steadier work. It's not like crime is ever going to go away.
Kelly glanced at Decker.
If you weren't a cop, what would you be?
Unemployed, answered Decker quite truthfully.
Chapter 35. Milton Ames and Peter Gunther were waiting for them in the dining hall. They were dressed the same as before, but each man seemed paler, with Ames looking feeble and disoriented. He mumbled,
"When can we have Pammy's remains? We have to bury her properly."
"I'll let you know as soon as possible, Milton," said Kelly in a gentle tone. "It shouldn't be too much longer."
Did they have to, you know?
They had to perform an autopsy, yes,
said Jameson quietly.
It's legally required under the circumstances.
I guess so. Susan keeps asking. We want to.
Kelly said,
"We're doing all we can. Please believe that."
"I do, Joe. Thank you."
Decker said,
"I know you didn't keep a file on Kramer's documents, but after she gave you the information about her undergraduate degree, did you check with Amherst to see if she actually went there?"
Ames said firmly,
"No, we didn't. Why would she lie about that?"
Gunther chimed in,
"And why would someone come all the way out here with a made-up story? We can't pay a lot. What would be her motive to lie to us about her past? I just don't see it."
"Well, if she wanted to disappear but needed a job to support herself, that would be one motive,"
said Jameson. Gunther's expression showed clearly that he did not believe this to be a plausible explanation. Jameson said,
"Did she give you references from past places of work that you could check out? She'd been out of school for about 8 years. She had to have held other jobs in the meantime."
Gunther and Ames exchanged a glance. Decker said,
"During job interviews, you always ask about a potential hire's experience. You check references."
Gunther placed his hands together and said quietly,
"We needed a teacher, and she was the only one to apply for the job. It's not like we could be choosy."
"Teaching is a lot of work," added Ames, "and a person could come here and make twice what we were offering just to be a cashier at a truck stop. So when she applied for the position, we were thrilled."
"In fact, I imagine you were desperate for someone,"
said Jameson.
"Yes."
"How'd she find out you needed a teacher in the first place?" asked Decker.
Gunther answered,
"We placed an ad online and also in the local paper. She apparently saw it and came in. She interviewed very well. She brought model lesson plans with her, seemed very well prepared to teach our children, and appeared happy and well adjusted. And she had done a very good job for the time that she was here. Susan told you that herself, if you recall."
Ames said,
"But why all these questions about Irene's past? How is that relevant to what happened to her? She was a prostitute. Don't a lot of them have bad things happen to them? I mean, it's just the nature of the beast, isn't it?"
"It can be, yes,"
said Jameson.
"But we have to follow up other angles as well."
"We're just trying to trace her past. It might have an impact on what happened to her," explained Kelly. "At least we can't discount that yet."
"Meaning it might be someone from her past who killed her?"
"Could be."
Gunther nodded.
"Well, that is a little comforting. At least it might not be anyone from London. I would hate to think that we might have a brutal killer running around here."
"You'd be surprised how many places have brutal killers running around,"
said Decker, drawing a sharp look from Gunther.
Ames said, "I know that you have to look into what happened to Irene, but do you have any clue as to who killed my daughter?"
Decker looked at Ames.
"As Detective Kelly said, we're working hard on it. Both these cases are a priority for us."
"Do you think they might be connected?"
asked Gunther.
How so? Asked Kelly.
Well, both women had ties to this place. Both were killed when they were off our property. Do you think it might be someone who had a grudge against our lifestyle and beliefs? These things do happen. Religious persecution.
Yes, they do,
said Jameson.
And we will look at that angle, although Kramer was not a member of the colony.
Someone might have held it against her that she taught here, or had a mistaken belief that she was a member somehow.
Again, we will look into that,
said Jameson, glancing at Decker.
Kelly added,
Do you have any idea where Pamela might have been living in London?
She never told me, said Ames.
He paused and his expression grew uncomfortable. Jameson was quick to pick up on this and said,
Is there something on your mind?
The way she was dressed when she was found? I saw the clothing. She never had clothing like that when she lived here. I saw how she dressed at the truck stop, but this was far more. What was going on there? I would like to know. And Susan asked me about it, too. She was deeply worried.
Kelly said,
She might have just been, you know, trying out a new style.
Ames said,
You don't think she was, I mean, sex? With Hal Parker? She wouldn't have done that because she found him attractive. He was older than we were.
He looked down.
But she might have. He stopped and shook his head. No, I cannot believe something like that about my daughter. She would not have done that. Never.
Decker said,
The post-mortem showed that they didn't have sex, if that makes you feel better.
Ames put his head in his hands, moaned, and looked like he might retch right there on the flowery tablecloth. Decker reached out and put his hand on Ames's shoulder.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ames. I just wanted you to know that whatever she went there for, that particular act didn't happen with Hal Parker, okay? Just put that right out of your mind, and tell your wife that, too.
Ames lifted his head, rubbed his eyes dry, and nodded.
Okay, right. Thank you.
When Decker glanced at Jameson, she was gaping. She quickly said to Gunther,
We understand that you bought some land from the Air Force and then leased some of it to frackers?
Gunther nodded.
Yes, the lease payments have come in very handy. It was one of the best investments we made, winning that auction.
I'm sure,
said Jameson.
Decker said, Did you ever notice anything odd at the Air Force facility?
Odd? I haven't, but I don't really pay attention to it.
Gunther looked at Ames. What about you, Milton?
My home is not near there, but there are others who do live closer to the facility. I can ask them.
Do you mind if we do that? And if we could meet with them now? Said Decker.
Gunther said, All right, but what is all this about?
I wish I could tell you, said Decker, but I'm not sure myself.
Chapter 36 Judith and Robert White sat across the table from Decker, Jameson, and Kelly in the dining hall. They were young, having been married for less than 3 years, but she was already pregnant with her second child. Her scarf was colorful, his clothes were dark and nondescript. He looked nervous, she looked intrigued. They had been asked to come here because their small farm was closest to the Air Force's outer perimeter fencing. Robert fiddled with his hat and looked at his feet while Decker scrutinized the pair.
Anything you can tell us, he said, now looking directly at Judith, whether it seems important or not.
Robert shrugged and glanced up.
I don't know nothing.
His wife elbowed him in the arm.
Bobby, tell them.
Shush, Judy. This is no business of ours.
Two women have been killed,
said Jameson.
One of them lived here, and the other worked here. That makes it our business.
Judith started to tear up.
Bobby, tell them. It's important. Oh, poor Pammy and Ms. Kramer.
Robert straightened, resignation clear on his features.
Okay. There were odd noises at night.
Odd? Like what? Asked Decker.
Planes coming and going. Choppers doing the same.
seen the lights going over our house.
And the dogs. Tell them about the dogs,
implored his wife. Robert sat up straighter and his expression became somber.
They got guard dogs there. Fierce things. We got a puppy. Went over to the outer fence one time, just curious. Well, thank God there were two fences between it and them. Thought they were going to tear right through both to get our little pup.
And tell them about the you-know-what,
prompted Judith. Robert screwed up his mouth and shook his head. Decker leaned in.
The you-know-what?
The man,
said Judith.
Bobby, if you won't tell them, I will.
Good Lord, woman, don't you see what you're getting us into, talking like that?
The truth is always better, said Decker. You tell the truth, you won't get in any trouble.
Says you, retorted Robert.
Bobby!
Exclaimed his wife. He sighed again.
It was about a month ago, late. I couldn't sleep. I was out in my little workshop repairing some tools. It's about 100 yards from the fence. That's when I heard a commotion outside, around 2 in the morning. We've never had any problems around here, but, well, this sounded not good. I picked up an axe from my workbench and went outside. I could hear the sounds of someone running, and there were shouts, and then I heard those dogs barking. They were in a frenzy, seemed like. I ran over toward the fence, but stopped before I got there because I could see lights. They were wobbling around because the people holding them were running.
Go on, said Kelly.
I got scared, so I dropped to the ground, but I kept watching. It was a pretty full moon that night. And then out of the darkness, this man jumps up on the inner fence, and he's trying to climb to the top.
What did he look like? Asked Decker.
He had a beard, and his hair was all wild and thick-like. Tall, and he looked skinny, but he was climbing that fence for all he was worth.
Clothing?
Like overalls, and his feet were bare.
What happened next?
Asked Jameson.
He was halfway to the top when a dog got to him. Jumped up and grabbed a hold of his pants leg. He was screaming.
Could you understand anything he said?
No, I was too far away, and it sounded like gibberish to me. I think he was crazy or on drugs or something, but I would have been doing the same thing if a dog had a hold of me like that. Then the men came running up, and they called the dog off and pulled him down from the fence. He just gave up and went limp. A truck pulled up, and they put him in that, and it drove off. Then the others left. By the time I got back to the house, I was shaking like a leaf.
He was,
said Judith.
I made him some tea to help him calm down. That's when he told me what happened.
Decker eyed Kelly, who looked both concerned and confused.
Did you tell anybody else about this?
Asked Jameson.
No, said Robert. Look, it's the government. I don't want to get mixed up in any of that. I'm just a farmer. We want to be left alone, that's all.
Judith said excitedly.
Do you think this has anything to do with Miss Kramer and Pammy?
It might, said Kelly, while Decker sat back and stared at the ceiling, lost in thought. Jameson said,
Did you know Pamela and Irene Kramer?
Judith nodded.
I knew Pammy pretty well. She didn't like it here. Our son is only 1, so he's not in school, but I helped out Miss Kramer some in the schoolroom. I helped the last teacher we had, too.
Did Kramer ever say anything to you that seemed odd? Did she mention the Air Force facility?
No, never.
Judith paused.
She did ask me where in the colony I lived.
And you told her?
Said Jameson.
Yes, it was funny, though.
What was?
Jameson said quickly.
Well, we practice communal living here, and with a lot of Anabaptist colonies, everyone usually lives in little houses next to each other or attached. I know this because my second cousin is a Hutterite, lives in North Dakota, too, only not near here.
Decker was now eyeing her steadily. And your point? He said.
Well, here there's enough land for all of us to have our own place, and we each grow some of our own crops. We contribute most of it to the colony, but we get to keep some for our own use. And folks can grow different things that they might like that the colony doesn't grow collectively.
And your point?
Decker said again.
I told Miss Kramer about that, and it was just funny what she said. She said to maybe not do that, to maybe not grow our own food.
Why would she say that?
Asked Jameson, glancing at Decker.
I don't know. She never said.
Decker said urgently,
Where does she teach class here?
In the little schoolhouse next to the building where we have the egg production, said Robert.
Does she have an office there?
Judith nodded.
In a room in the back?
Decker rose.
Can you show us? Now?
Chapter 37 Doris, the colony teacher, answered their knock. She was in her 50s and dressed like the other women at the colony, but with a different color and pattern for her skirt and scarf. Behind her, they could see students ranging in age from 6 to teens, sitting in separate clusters in the middle of the large room. They all looked at the visitors with both interest and puzzlement. After Judith introduced Kelly, Decker, and Jameson, Doris explained she was filling in for Kramer.
It was so terrible about Irene,
she said in a low voice.
Yeah, said Decker distractedly. Look, we need to see Kramer's office.
Oh, all right. It's this way.
She led them past the students. Several of the younger boys looked up at the giant Decker in awe, while several of the teenage boys watched the pretty Jameson every step of the way. Doris opened the door to a small room and ushered them in. It was 10 by 10 with one window. A small desk sat in the middle of the room, with a straight-backed chair slid into the knee hole. Two metal file cabinets were set against one wall. On the desk was an ink blotter, a Rolodex, a stack of books, and what looked to be some student journals. Doris and Judith left them there to look around.
What are we looking for? Asked Kelly. Anything that will help us, replied Decker. Well, that's kind of vague.
Decker thinks that Kramer's murder might be tied to something in her past, before she came here.
Jameson glanced at Decker.
Old sins cast long shadows, or something to that effect.
Kelly looked intrigued by that.
So, before she came here, then? Which is maybe why the feds are interested?
Decker nodded.
Yes. I think finding out the reason she came here in the first place will go a long way toward helping find who killed her. So are you thinking her murder had something to do with her past?
It's certainly possible,
noted Jameson.
Works for me.
Kelly slid open the desk drawers and looked through them, even checking underneath each one. Jameson started going through the books and journals, while Decker popped open one of the file cabinet drawers and began searching.
Nothing here, said Kelly a while later.
Same here,
said Jameson as she put down the last journal, while Decker was still poring through the file cabinets. Jameson sat down at the desk and pulled the Rolodex towards her.
Funny thing to have these days, especially for a young person.
Decker looked up from the cabinet drawer.
Anything in there?
Jameson flipped through some of the cards, starting with the letter A.
They look to be all empty,
she said.
Why have an empty Rolodex on your desk?
Decker walked over, took it from her, and started going through each card. Finally, near the end, he pulled out one that had some writing on it.
What letter was that under? Asked Kelly.
Decker said,
I think Kramer was trying to be cute. It was under X, as in X marks the spot. And I guess she was counting on the fact that almost no one would search every card.
Well, she didn't count on you,
quipped Jameson.
What does it say? Asked Kelly.
Decker read off the card.
Lesson Plan C, dated December 15th of last year.
Any idea what that might mean?
Asked Jameson. In answer, Decker raced back over to the file cabinet, quickly searched through the material there, and pulled out a scheduling binder. He flipped it open to December.
Okay, on December 15th, she's written the name Bud, Green Hills Nursing Home, Williston, North Dakota.
He looked up,
and there's an address and phone number.
Why would she have written that down in a lesson plan? Asked Kelly.
Well, considering the subterfuge with the Rolodex, she probably didn't want it listed on her phone, but still wanted it around to refer to.
Williston isn't that far from here, said Kelly. You want to go check it out?
Yes, but call first and see if they have anyone named Bud there.
Kelly took out his phone, looked at the number on the page, and made the call. He spoke into the phone for a bit and then waited for about a minute.
They're checking, he said.
Someone came back on the line and he listened for a few moments. He clicked off and looked at them.
They don't have anyone named Bud living there, nor anyone who lived there recently with that name.
It might be a nickname,
said Jameson.
Which means we need to take a trip to Williston, said Decker.
They left and climbed into the SUV.
You think this might finally be a break? Said Kelly.
From your lips to God's ear, replied Decker.
I'll take a little divine intervention about now,
chimed in Jameson.
Looks like a nice enough place,
said Jameson, as a little over an hour later she steered the SUV into the parking lot of the Green Hills nursing home. They climbed out and went inside. At the front desk was a young woman dressed in blue scrubs.
May I help you?
Kelly showed his credentials, as did Decker and Jameson. That got them referred to the supervisor on duty, a woman in her 50s with short white hair, a portly frame, and a disagreeable look on her face.
I spoke to you earlier,
she said to Kelly when he explained what they wanted.
We don't have anyone here named Bud.
That's probably a nickname, said Kelly.
So what's his full name?
She said.
Well, if we knew that, I would have given it to you already.
Did you ever have an Irene Kramer work here? Asked Decker.
Kramer? Irene Kramer? No, I don't believe so. Look, what is this all about?
Kelly took out a copy of Kramer's driver's license and showed it to the woman.
This is Irene Kramer.
The woman put on a pair of glasses and looked closely at the photo.
Why, that's Mary Rice. At least, that was her name when she worked here.
When was that? Asked Decker.
Come to my office.
They followed her down the hall to a small, windowless room with drab furniture. She sat down at her desk and logged on to her desktop computer.
Her last paycheck was issued about 14 months ago.
What did she do here?
Asked Jameson.
She worked with our residents. She did physical therapy with them.
And she was certified to do that? Asked Decker.
Yes, she had all the proper paperwork.
And you checked on all that? Her references and all?
Yes, that's our proper procedure. Everything was above board.
Can we get copies of all that? Asked Kelly.
Not without a warrant. I'm not looking to bring a lawsuit down on this place. Now, I don't know what she's involved in, but if Mary were to find out...
Mary is dead, said Decker, so she won't be doing any suing.
Dead?
She was murdered, which is the reason we're here.
Oh, my God.
And you're sure you don't have anyone here named Bud?
Said Jameson.
Quite sure. I know all the residents. There's no one here with that name or nickname.
Decker interjected.
But what about with those initials? B-U-D.
The woman started to peck on the computer keyboard. A few minutes passed as she scrolled through some screens. Then she stopped and smiled.
It's Brad. Bradley Unger Daniels. That's B-U-D, right?
Yes, it is, said Decker.
Chapter 38.
Mary?
Said Brad Daniels. He was old and shrunken and seated in a wheelchair in the tiny antiseptic room he would call home for the remainder of his life. Decker, Jameson, and Kelly were seated across from him, pretty much filling up the small space. Jameson nodded.
Yes, Mary Rice. She worked here a little over a year ago as a physical therapist.
Daniels's arthritic fingers clutched the head of his cane.
Mary! Okay, yeah, I knew her.
They had been told that Daniels was in his 90s and had been at the facility for 10 years. His wife was dead. He had outlived his siblings and even both his children. His grandchildren lived out of state and came once a year at Christmas to visit him. Kelly had tried to show him the picture of Kramer, but Daniels shook his head.
Can't really see no more.
Decker looked around the room. Next to the bed on a small shelf were some pictures of little kids and what looked to be birthday cards. On the nightstand was a ball cap. It was one worn by people who had served in World War II and denoted their branch of service.
You were in the Air Force in World War II? Said Decker, glancing at the hat.
Called it the Army Air Forces back then, said Daniels, smiling feebly. Was the Army Air Corps before that. Didn't come to be the U.S. Air Force till later.
Were you a pilot?
Asked Jameson.
No, a navigator.
He perked up.
Flew on the B-17, 24, and the big boy, the B-29 Super Fortress. Boy, those were some exciting times.
Navigator, huh? Said Kelly.
Daniel slowly nodded.
Always liked that stuff. Signals, radio waves, radar, which was new back then. Got us where we were going, and then got us back. Did a lot of bombing runs. Thought I was going to die every time. Never managed to.
He chuckled softly.
What did you do after the war? Did you leave the service? Asked Decker.
No, I stuck around and worked for the government.
What did you do?
Asked Jameson.
Now the man's weakened eyes narrowed.
Why do you want to know?
He said, his tone suddenly sharp. Decker squatted down in front of the man.
Did you talk to Mary about some of the things you'd done?
You haven't answered my question yet, so why should I answer yours?
You liked Mary?
She was a nice gal, patient, pushed me to do my therapy, but she did it in a way that wasn't too overbearing, like some of them can be here. I liked her. Too bad when she left. Where'd she get to?
Would it surprise you to learn that she moved to London, North Dakota?
The old man flinched.
London?
Yes, it's where the Douglas S. George Defense Complex is located.
Well, I know that.
Because you worked there? A long time ago? Said Decker.
Maybe I did and maybe I didn't. But if I did, it's classified, said Daniels.
He closed his eyes and gripped the head of his cane tighter.
But you talked to Mary about it.
How do you know that? Said Daniels. Did she say I did?
No, but why else would she have moved up there? I mean, otherwise, it's a really big coincidence.
I got nothing to say on that subject.
Did you know that the Air Force sold most of the land around the radar facility?
Sold the land, said Daniels sharply. To who?
A religious organization called the Brothers. Ever heard of them?
Daniels shook his head.
And they in turn leased some of the land to frackers.
Frackers?
Companies that drill down for oil and gas.
They're drilling on that land?
Asked Daniels.
Yes.
Decker glanced at Kelly and then Jameson. He turned back to Daniels. The old man was staring directly at him.
The thing is, we unfortunately can't talk to Mary.
Don't know where she is, then, Daniels said.
No, we do.
So what's the problem?
Someone murdered her.
The old man seized up. For a moment, Decker thought he might be having a stroke.
Get out of here, he suddenly roared, blinking away tears. You just get out of here right now. Leave me alone. Leave me the hell alone.
A uniformed nurse rushed into the room.
Mr. Daniels?
She said frantically.
What's wrong?
He pointed at the others.
These people are harassing me. I want them to leave.
The nurse looked sternly at the three. Jameson held out her FBI badge and said,
We had to ask him some difficult questions because of a police investigation.
Oh, I see, but he's upset now. I think you should leave. He's not in the best of health.
Jameson tugged on Decker's arm.
I think you're right. We're going.
They left the room. As they walked down the hall, Decker said,
He knows. He told Kramer something that made her quit her job here, change her name, and move to London.
We just don't know what, said Kelly.
He worked at the Air Force station,
said Jameson.
That has to be the connection. He said he was a navigator and was into radar and radio waves and all. That's what they do up in London.
We need to find out when he was there exactly, said Decker. It's been around since the 50s, you said?